This is the MagicWordPodcast.com.
Hello, this is Scott Wells for the MagicWordPodcast.com. And I want to welcome you again to 2020 or 2020 or however you want to say it. Here we are. We have already had one week last week that was a podcast that went over very well. In fact, it was our most successful podcast of the year. Okay, that was our first and only one so far this year. But it really did outscore a lot of the others, I think, just because we had a lot of people who were on that. We had a dozen different people who were talking about their interest in magic, how they got involved later in life. And apparently, I kind of touched upon a nerve. There were a lot of people who were very interested in that episode, which kind of makes me think perhaps in the future that we might be doing some other types of things where we have multiple voices. I normally have that, of course, obviously, when I go to magic conventions. But whenever that I'm having just a regular podcast, typically it's one-on-one, maybe one-on-two or three, but not very often do we have some various voices like we had last week. And it seemed to be something that resonated with you, the listener. And thank you very much for tuning in and to listening to that one, and for the kind comments that I've gotten from not only those people who were involved directly with the podcast, but others who had listened and who were encouraged by that and saying, hey, I got started late in life. It's good to kind of hear other people who have done the same thing too. If you haven't had a chance to listen to that episode, go back and take a listen. I think it was one of the better ones. It was really kind of interesting. Well, it was very interesting, not just kind of interesting. It was one I know that you will enjoy. Well, this week's episode is brought to you by the Friends of the Magic Word, and as we start into this new year, we want to welcome the first of our new year friends, and that is Basil Barkham. I want to thank you, Basil, very much for joining, and I want to thank all the rest of the people who are the listeners and the contributors financially through their pledges and regular donations. Thank you guys so much for all that you do in order to help make this podcast continue on year after year. And if you're interested in finding out more about how that you can become a member and also get some pretty cool perks, just go to the magicwordpodcast.com, click on the tab, and you'll find out more information there. Well, this week we are going to be talking with Nathan Coe Marsh, who is a corporate entertainer. I think it's interesting about he has gone through various ways of trying to find out who he is, but once he decided the kind of character or the kind of person he is or what it is that he wanted to do, then he has made a concerted effort and a focus like a beeline exactly to what he wants and has been very successful in that market and continues to be then as well. So he tells us a little bit about how that he had made that decision and then also gives us some performing tips, a few ideas that he has taken from some other people that he shares with us, as well is actually tipping a lot of the tricks that he does in his regular corporate act. He doesn't talk about the lines or anything like that, but at least kind of just a running order of things that he does. He was a lecturer who had come through this past year, and I had a chance to visit with him when he came through Houston, and I really enjoyed our conversation, and I know that you will too. So please welcome this week's guest, Mr. Nathan Coe Marsh, here on The Magic Word. Hello, this is Scott Wells for the MagicWordPodcast.com. And today we are speaking here in Houston with a magician who has been traveling about on a lecture tour, and he's here in Houston then right now. And he has a varied background, certainly, and I know we're going to cover a lot of this here today in working with the corporate markets, as well as having been on Penn & Teller Foolus, has done also an Armed Forces tour. What was that?
Yes, right? Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
And also, have you done some cruise ships?
I've done a few cruises, yeah.
Okay,
yeah,
yep.
Yeah.
And also college circuit?
No, I've done one college gig in my life.
Okay, so. So I won't include that in the bio over here.
Right.
So, but somebody that you may have seen on television or may not have, if not that you are going to get to know him here today, please welcome my friend Nathan Coe Marsh. Hey there, Nathan.
Such a thrill to be here, Scott.
Well, thank you very much. I'm glad that you're here as well. So, as I mentioned about the lecture tour, how's the tour been going so far?
It's been great. It's been fun meeting groups.
Yeah.
And just, it's incredible what a varied community we have of magic.
Yeah.
And also how each community, you know, you go to each little city and the well of expertise that is, you know, like there's some really great magicians out there, and it's good to kind of connect individually and see those.
That's an interesting point. Do you notice when you go from city to city or club to club that is there a general interest more in close-up and stage in children's magic, a variety? I mean, like some clubs, maybe there are a lot of kids show magicians or a lot of guys who are like, are there some younger people? What are you seeing as far as a mix of clubs?
I think there's definitely a huge mix. And it's definitely, I think it's really the case that some areas have a tone that's set in terms of people see, you know, we see first what's around us and we get excited when somebody's doing something really good.
Right.
And so, yeah, if there are areas where there's really good card work going on, there are more people that are interested in that and are, mm-hmm. are looking to do that. And I think that's a big part of, you know, if you kind of zoom out and look globally, it's a big part of, you know, the big part of why Spain has such great magic and why the Netherlands has some great magic, but with a different tone. You know, you can see the Caps influence as it circles down. You can see the Tamaris influence as it circles down. And so it is kind of cool seeing the little flavor in different regions. And sometimes it's less distinct and sometimes it's very distinct. But and sometimes, you know, being reminded of the forgotten history of going through Omaha and being reminded by the club members that that is Johnny Carson's home and Walter Graham and, you know, the wonderful Abbott book, the David P. Abbott mm-hmm. House of Mysteries. And just that there's this really rich vein of history in this one little area. And so it's kind of cool to see that and to meet all the different personalities. And we've got some characters.
Yes, we do.
It's been good.
It's interesting that you mentioned that. I hadn't thought about that until just this last week. I was having a conversation with somebody about that very thing, about how that certain areas seem to be influenced that tends to dominate the type of magic that they will do in an area. As you mentioned, in Spain, for an example, with the Tamaris and his school. In Israel, with Uri Geller, you know, there are a lot of mentalists, you know, that come from Israel. And with each of the different pockets around the area, you know, that it tends to kind of be influenced by whoever might be there. In Chicago, it may have been Jay Marshall, you know, so he did a lot of stand-up and comedy and stuff, you know, and there.
Well, and Chicago's a really interesting case because you've got these, it's one of those, I really love the Chicago tradition because you've got these two very definite veins, that you've got the very technical from the Ed Marlowe influence.
Right.
And then you've got the cabaret, but just highly entertaining, layperson driven of Don Allen and, mm-hmm. You know, that tradition as well. So it's this really, Chicago's always been a really interesting scene to me in terms of those two threads kind of meeting.
That's true. There's been a lot, you know, I think when I think of Chicago, I think of Chicago bar magic.
Sure.
You know, of people like Shulian's and other places, you know, like that have, you know, I think Johnny Paul was there. Of course, Johnny Thompson was from there.
Oh, yeah.
I think Johnny Platt may have even been up there, you know, then as well. And right now, Dennis Watkins has got a show that is kind of a close-up or stand-up show that he does at the Palmer House. In addition to the plays, and Chicago's got a nice, rich vibe, I think, certainly too.
Yeah.
You know, when you come to Houston, you know, we have, it's interesting, you know, we've got people from Danny Garcia to Walter Blaney, you know, from close
right.
up the stage, you know, so.
Right, right, yeah.
It certainly is varied. Now, I was going to talk with you a little bit about, you mentioned you haven't really done the college circuit or anything. Did you ever think about going on that? I mean, that's like a whole...
Yeah, it's always, you know, the fantasy of the college circuit is back in the days where, you know, I guess it was Carrot Top or Seinfeld or whoever who did one showcase and got 240 bookings out of it, right? You know, you always hear those stories and you're like, man, that would be really nice to do one show and just have a whole year filled from it. I don't know that, like, when I look at my... It's definitely possible that I could create a character and a brand and everything that would really speak to that market. I've invested so much in a very particular kind of image that's been driven towards the meetings and events market that I don't, you know, it would be everything you do, right? Every time we go into a different market, my friend Jason Markles likes to point out you're creating a brand new business
mm-hmm,
because
mm-hmm.
you've got a different value proposition. You've got a different audience. And they're looking for something very different. And so there's going to be a huge output of effort and time and resources to really build momentum in that specific market. It's very hard to cross over. It's very hard to, and not that it can't be done. So to me, it's the college market has always seemed like something very, it's like that would have been very interesting if I had started down that road 10 years ago.
It is a specialty market.
But I don't see the value in putting that effort in for myself to just become a, you know, to just become, and it feels like that market's a little bit saturated, and it might be, you know, talking to, I have good friends who have been major figures in that market over the years, and this might be something that any working pro says about their own market because they're trying to, you know, like dissuade others from going
in.
But there are kind of legitimate concerns about that being a very saturated market and very, very price conscious, and once people are willing to come in and kind of undercut what had been the established going rate, it really dilutes the market for everybody else, you know?
Right. Well, once that you have a particular brand in particular, you know, they're, as magicians get involved in magic, I mean, you start off and you start doing some stuff and you kind of do a little bit of everything and you try and find what you, what area, you know, is your level of comfort. And it always bothers me. People say, well, I do it all, you know, birthday parties and bar mitzvahs and trade shows and everything. Well, but, you know, what is your specialty, you know, kind of a thing? Because otherwise that you're, I mean, there's nothing wrong with a general practitioner, you know, certainly. But the people who stand out as the A magicians would be those people who specialize, you know, like, let's say, Matt King, you know, or Murray Sawchuk, or somebody who actually says, I'm going to do this. I'm going to be an illusionist. I'm going to be a comedian, you know, comedy magic or something like that. In this case, I think really that you have focused mainly on what, the corporate market, I assume?
I would say the corporate market, it's shifted a little bit for me recently that I went through about a short period of, I did about 6 months where I was just on ships, and that was way too much time away and travel and felt like I was kind of living on vacation, you know, and it wasn't.
That's a life choice too. There again, you know, once you go to sea, that's another thing is that when you go to sea, I talked to so many guys saying that they lose all their contacts because people who were booking their shows are now saying, well, they're not available. And then they'll start booking other people and then you kind of lose them basically.
Yeah.
Too.
And I had even in that 6 month period, I had a little bit, and I think it was more from, I think I settled in and got comfortable and got like, okay, I've got this rhythm going and I stopped. It was harder to prospect on land. It was harder to be in touch with potential customers on land. So I kind of settled out of that and I felt the wave of getting off the ship, you know, I think a little bit after and still do in fewer proposals and fewer, just because I've missed that period of being in front of people. And I think that's kind of what I didn't like about that market was there's this paranoia of, it's the golden handcuffs, you know, it's a great opportunity. It's,
you get to travel and, just do a few shows a week and get paid well.
Yeah, exactly. And that's great. But there's also the paranoia of, oh, if this goes away, what do I have? You know, because you haven't been building, you know, if you haven't been building the other side of the business on land. So, but prior to that, for about 10 years, my sole focus was after dinner shows and, a bit of MC work. And then, when I was first starting my career, I started in close up and then I made a very conscious decision to go away from strolling because I found that it wasn't natural. It wasn't a natural strength for me to interrupt people and, kind of bust in and I will now entertain you even though you weren't expecting this. And there are people who are phenomenal at that. And there are people who I see just make people comfortable instantly. And it's a gift and it's a strength. And more I'm a believer in instead of putting energy into trying to compensate for your weaknesses, right? Instead of being like, oh, I'm weak in this area, let me get stronger there. What happens if I put that same level of energy into getting better at something that I'm already good at, something that's already a strength? So instead of going from weak to mediocre in one area, going from good to better in another area. So I just said, I'm done with strolling and I put everything into stand up and stage. And so that's really been my market is, and I'm still in the process of figuring out in terms of a niche from the client side, what the best fit is for me now. Like, mm-hmm. that's still an active process of exploring, but it is stand-up comedy, you know, call it parlor platform, you know, small stage. Like, that's the venue, right? That's the and then there are different places that can be used. So,
well, as far as the strolling goes, that a lot of times that is kind of something else that is offered. In other words, I'm sure that the clients will say, do you also offer a little bit of something you can do during cocktail time?
Yeah. And if they do, I will. The only times I'll stroll now is when I am doing the show afterwards. And I only do it if it's something that the client.
So you're not selling that as a separate thing.
I'm
you're
not
saying
pushing
I'm doing
it
the stage
and I'm
show.
Not, and I'm not pushing it as a separate package. And that's just a business decision that I've made, that uh-huh. the stage show is such a focus for me, and I've got a timeline. I've got, at this time I arrive, at this time I'm loading in, at this time I'm sound checking, and I do that for myself internally.
How long does that take? I mean, when you're going to, let's say we're going to be working, we're right now as we're speaking,
2 hours prior to guest arrival.
Okay. And so in your contract, you tell them, I will be coming in, I need to have this
I
kind of
I don't want
or?
To, in the contract, if they ask, background is that most of the events that I'm working, they're doing a multi-day conference anyways. So they've got the AV team is there at different times and they're like, what, and they're asking me, what time would you like to do a sound check? And I'm letting them know that what I guarantee, I give myself a buffer for myself. I'm arriving 2 hours prior to guest arrival and the contract I'm guaranteeing that I'll be there an hour prior to guest arrival. So I'm giving myself a little bit of buffer in case something, you know, if there's that disastrous accident or...
So if cocktails are supposed to start at 6, you say in the contract, I'll be there by 5, but
so
you're...
So it's doors, it's... Yeah, so... And it's not necessarily when cocktails start because typically...
Say 5:30.
Because typically cocktails are happening in a pre-function space.
Right.
So if they're... If that's in the pre-function, I'm basing that arrival time on when the doors to the room that I'm performing in open.
Okay.
So if the guests are entering to go in and get their salads or whatnot mm-hmm. at 6 o'clock, I'm in that room at 4 o'clock. And so for me, and I have, you know, I've got my two different things that I've set up, two different checklists. So I've got the checklist of everything that needs to be set up on stage. And that's its own thing. Mm-hmm. So I set up everything that's set up on stage. And then I have everything that's set up on my person that gets set up in the green room, right?
In your pockets and things you're talking about?
Yeah, pockets. Yeah, okay. Exactly. Stuff. What am I actually carrying with me on mm-hmm. stage, right? Mm-hmm. And so all of that stuff on the stage, obviously, I want set and all the tech handled.
You certainly don't want to do that when there are people, when the guests are there.
Exactly.
That's one of the worst things I hate whenever that you're hearing a sound check in the background during a cocktail.
Yes.
It's horrible.
It's the worst.
It's very unprofessional.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And so, yeah. So for me, that sweet spot is if I arrive an hour prior to the sound check, right? If we do that sound check an hour before the doors open, which is when I'm contractually obligated to be there, all my gear's loaded in, my stage is set up. I've got everything in the green room that needs to be there. I may not be there. I have a chance to change because I'm bringing my clothes. If I'm traveling there, I'm just changing in my green room is my hotel room and I'm coming down to the room, right. In the clothes I'm gonna wear on stage. But if I'm driving there, I'm not wearing my stage clothes to drive in. Right. So, so that's another step. So there are all these things that have to be done to, and I want my full focus to be on making that stage show as good as it can be. So that's why I don't introduce the idea of strolling, because now I've got to build another hour in to get all that stuff done and then go out and mingle and take care of the strolling work.
Good point.
And it's great for, you know, strolling has its place. It's great for if they like you already before you come on stage.
That's
half the battle.
Right. 100%. They don't mind coming up on stage because, hey, he's a likable guy. He's not going to embarrass me and we're going to have some fun.
Yeah, absolutely. And so, yeah, so that's the trade-off that you make. And for me, part of it is just that I feel more at home in front of a group of, I'm one of those people that, like, if I'm alone on an elevator, that's a much more stressful experience than if I have to get up and talk in front of 1,000 people, right? So the fact that I'm more comfortable with it means I'm probably better at it. And, you know, means that their first introduction to me isn't something that isn't my best.
Right.
You know?
Right. So whatever that you're going to be doing an evening show like that, and because you had to be there for a few hours early, do, and obviously you're going to be spending the night there at the hotel, at the venue. Do you come in a day before and say, look, I need to be in the night before?
Oh yeah.
And you have two nights.
So it's two nights. Yeah. So if I'm flying in, yeah, absolutely. It's two nights.
To make sure that you're not going to be delayed due to weather or anything with the flights.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Good advice. Also, when you're setting up on stage, does the stuff, the things that you have on stage, does it depend upon the size of your audience? In other words, do you have a larger or smaller act if there are going to be 120 people versus 1,200 people?
I don't. There are, There are adjustments that I might make. Mm-hmm. So there are, so for a smaller group, there are pieces that are ruled out for me. So I do a linking finger ring routine, you know, that's ruled out with a very small group. If we've got 10 people, that method's not going to work. So those are the kinds of adjustments that I make.
I found that also, by the way, if you have an elderly crowd for the linking finger rings, because they can't get their fingers off arthritic fingers.
Yeah.
I've learned that a long time ago.
Yeah.
The hard way.
A great, you know, Nick LaCapo, who is a magician I came up with. We worked at Theater Magic with Shopping Universal together. Great guy. But he has a great workaround with that where, and it doesn't, to a very elderly crowd, it doesn't help, but he will say, if you have a ring and it slides off, you take a moment, slide it off, put it in your palm.
Oh.
And that way, when you're going to people, you see the rings in their palm already. And you don't have this awkward moment that's Nick's. And I had asked him for permission to use it in my own presentation. He was like, sure, no problem. But things like that are, how do we streamline? You know, I used to do a piece that was a multiple phase of a ring vanishing and appearing on a shoelace, right? So using the brilliant Richard Sanders method, which is fantastic. And I found a way to kind of nest it and get some callbacks out of it and have it happen a couple times, which was great. And so the practical thing there was, I was going into that was nested into a different routine. So I needed the guys who were going to be on stage with me to have finger rings, right?
Sure.
And so what I did was I created a gag of polling the audience, which was, you know, where are my cat people? You know, so glad you could make it out of the house tonight. Where are my dog people? And there'd be a big roar. And where are my married people? And now I'm looking, right? Because I say, where are my married people? And then the joke after this is, oh, you guys are more enthusiastic about dogs. But when I see them, and I'm looking for younger married guys, because I know he's got a ring, and he got it within the last 2 years, so it's very likely that it's going to slide off. And I, for that particular piece at the time, I was doing it, and I no longer do that. I just do the linking finger rings. It's the only finger ring thing I do in my show. But at that time, then those are the guys that I would bring up for the thumb tie, and I would get their rings as part of that. But that way I knew in advance, right? So that's part of it, is like thinking, what are the awkward moments in your what are the potentially awkward moments in your show, and what can I do to set up, to, you know, like a pool player setting the shots up in advance, what can I do to make it so that those awkward moments don't happen?
Right. And to streamline it, as you say, so this way that you're not waiting for a moment for them to take it off. Oh, it won't come off. Well, let me get somebody else. I mean, there might be somebody who is anxious, for an example, to give you a ring, but it takes too long. So I love that kind of an idea. Yeah. And as you're saying, you know, that's just a minor thing, but it's a big thing that can streamline things. And so this way it's less time that you're having to spend in an awkward situation.
And likewise, like I move through the house while I'm doing the opening monologue for the ring, so that I'm towards the back of the house when it comes time for me to start borrowing the rings. Mm-hmm. Because what can happen is, if you're forward for the particular method and structure I'm using, I want to start with somebody in the back, because that's the ring I'm going to be switching, is that further back. And so I want him further from the stage, just as additional protection on the method, just as, you know, and so they're less likely to be comparing after the show, comparing their rings.
Right.
So by starting by doing the monologue as I'm moving through, not only am I kind of breaking the fourth wall, and it's this nice little variety because mm-hmm. now he's here with us.
So you start at the rear and work your way forward.
And work my way forward. Huh, and then you're not skipping people, because it looks weird if somebody's got the ring on the palm, like ready to give to you, and you walk past them because you know you have to start.
So you don't ask them until you get to the back of the room.
Yes.
Then to remove it.
Then to do it. So little things like that are how can I dodge problems before they happen, and just because right. what really elevates a show, and it's all these details are not things that the audience is conscious of, but what they are conscious of is this sense of seamlessness, that nothing seems effort. And this is a goal I work towards, and I'm not there by any means. This is physician heal thyself, but you see Copperfield and any small prop, it's just there. You don't notice who handed it to him. You don't notice where he picked it up from. And when he's done with it, it's just gone.
Right.
And it's not a magic trick, but it is. It's one of the most magical things of that show is how absolutely seamless this thing has been worked out.
Because he's done it so many times, just as you had your show.
Yeah.
That reminds me, whenever I had gone to his museum, and he and Chris Kenner were kind of going back and forth as they were describing everything, what I found one of the real puzzles was, where did these chairs appear from all of a sudden? And it's like, you turn around, he's sitting down. Where'd that chair? Well, he's got people who's bringing these chairs, and they'll remove them then as well and carry them around. It's like, that's kind of cool.
That's so cool. That's very Copperfield. Wow.
Yeah.
That's really cool. That's really cool.
Those are great ideas. And there are the fine points that really differentiate, I think, an amateur from a professional, certainly. And that's a lot of things that, directors will do for people when they mm-hmm. will say, okay, look, you need to stay in the middle of the stage, or, that you need to, why are you turning around and looking for something? You should know immediately where it is, left or right. And also even trying to get volunteers. Mm-hmm. How do you go about, this is something I'm always I'm curious about, is having to do with audience selection.
Yes.
Trying to get the right person. I have for a long time inadvertently been introducing my character. Like the first 8 to 10 mm-hmm. minutes is basically just me.
Yes.
So that way they get to know me.
Yes.
And I just heard a lecture from John Armstrong, who was talking about the very thing. It's like, I've already been doing that, but unconsciously. And he was saying, before you actually pull the first person up, they already know something about you and they accept you.
Yes.
So that makes a lot of sense. So when you pull up that first person, you've had that 8 or 10 minutes to kind of see how people are reacting, mm-hmm. I guess. And so you want to have someone, as opposed to, raise your hand and,
Yeah. I mean, I'm looking for a couple things. So because some tricks, I'm looking for who's the most responsive. So linking finger rings, the climatic moment for me is that woman. I've got the focal point is on stage for my routine, for my linking finger routine. The magic doesn't happen while I'm walking through the house, right?
Mm-hmm.
It happens on stage, and she's holding the pencil in one hand, she's holding the rings in the other, and she lifts up and discovers that they're linked right in front of her face. And so you get this sponge ball, you get this big reaction that's like sponge balls or whatever. And that's what carries it to the back of the house. So for that routine, I'm watching and I'm looking for somebody who is responding well to the magic, who seems very enthusiastic, but also who seems very relaxed and in possession of themselves, right? So who's not going to be afraid to just kind of let loose a little mm-hmm. bit and let them see that side.
What I hear you saying then really is that you are comfortable enough, you know exactly what you're doing, and that you're not focused on what's my next trick what you're going to say, because you've done the show, you're professional, know what you're doing, that you're paying more attention to the audience and how they're reacting. So this way you can get the right volunteer.
There was a great line that Michael Close quoted in one of the Workers books from Wendy Carlos Williams, who was a synthesizer composer, which was that for every element you can control, you must control. And there's so many, when you ask about the different shows and stuff, for me, just my act has been so much work and continues to be so much. I continue to experiment with new material in venues where it's appropriate, right?
Yeah.
Continues to be so much work, but that's the thing that I've got on lockdown. So now it's more about learning how to make that play to a more intimate room or a bigger room, rather than let me have a completely different show for these different environments, because there are so many elements that go into it, right?
Mm-hmm.
There's you've got this.
But there are some basic things in your show that that don't vary from show to show because that's you. And then I assume there's some other things you change out or not.
I really not.
No?
I mean,
like how many things are in your, what do you have, 45 minute show, an
so
hour?
My main show is about 50 to 60 or 45 if we're doing after dinner, right? So that's the 45 sweet point if they're doing dinner. If they're not doing dinner, which I've been doing more and more of, is people just coming into a space, it's set up theater style, and I do my show, and I love that. So let's see. Let me count them. So I open with a Roy Benson version of the lamp chimney vanish, and then I have a production that caps that. So that's my opener, and then we bounce a balloon through the house. We get a suit. We get a color. Excuse me, we get a color, we get a suit, we get a playing card, deck of cards is tossed in the air, the card they've named, I catch at my fingertips, and then that card is in the balloon that they've been bouncing around, right? Mm-hmm. So that's two. And then we go, I actually go a little earlier than I would like into a audience participation piece. And I do that polling the audience bit that I used to do to find who is the ring, but now it gives me a second to really survey them and watch them as I'm asking these questions, and we get a couple laughs and stuff like that out of them. And then I do a long piece with two people on stage, and the first thing that involves audience interaction involves two people, so they're more comfortable, because I'm not just bringing you up, and it's you alone on stage with me, right? And so we do a thumb tie that goes into a Bill and Fruit. Then we do, So then there's, Johnny Thompson's $100 prediction follows that with a Alcoran medallion at the front of it, kind of jammed together as one routine. It's a callback to the balloons, Pegasus page, linking finger ring and egg and silk. So that's five or six items.
I think that's about seven.
That's 55 minutes.
That's right. Because I've, remember talking one time with Fielding West, and he said, "What's in your show?" And I said, "I've got this and this." He said, "Yeah." And then I got this and this.
Yeah.
And after a while, it's like, "How long is your show?"
Right.
He said, "I do like four or five." And he said, "In an hour, and you've got like 15."
Yeah. And God bless people who can do that. I've just been watching Gazzo's Penguin Live Act, which I'm reviewing for Genie, and it's phenomenal. And he's spending 20. I think I counted, it's 26 minutes before the first moment of magic happens.
Really?
And it's great. I mean, it
mostly
is
comedy?
It's personality driven. He's got a great bit with these cookies, and but it's just him delivering lines and the audience loving him for 25 minutes and being shocked by him and wanting to see how far over the line he'll go for 25 minutes. And then some magic happens. And he does. Yeah, he does. He does. But I think they feel safe with him. Like, he's a really interesting performer that I think it's the kind of, that's a really dangerous act to do. It's a really difficult act to do. But it's about them feeling that there's this warm, loving center at the heart of the man. And if they don't feel that, that act doesn't work. And it's interesting because you watch him and you can see the moments when he can feel that they might drift away. And he starts to, so there's a little girl up there that he's delivering these lines to.
Right. And if he sees it's not working, then he...
And it's not even that he sees it's not working, but it's that I think it's a great metaphor. The bit he does at the beginning, he's literally handing them cookies, and then he's insulting the person he gives the cookie to, right? As he does it, and then he's got a punchline about the cookies at the end. That's great. There's a whole punchline to the bit, but that's a good metaphor for the whole act. That it's like he'll do this really rough line, and then it's like he gives the girl a cookie verbally. Like, he gets the audience on her side, and he acknowledges that he sympathizes with her and that she's in a difficult situation. And he'll say something very quickly, but he'll say something to acknowledge that. So it's like, we get that he gets what's going on, and we feel safe, right? And it's all entertainment is some kind of fantasy fulfillment.
Right.
And that act is fulfilling the fantasy, and it's escaping all these pressures that we have in our lives, right? And one of those pressures is the social pressure about what do we say around other people? What do we do? And sometimes you wish you could just say whatever you were thinking, right, around
right.
people. And Gazzo is the living fulfillment of that fantasy, right?
Good point.
And that's the appeal of the act.
Well, that leads me to something about what kind of empathy do you feel that the audience has for you? In other words, do you kind of cross that fourth wall by letting them see who Nathan Komarsh is personally? I mean, do you...
I try my best to, and I'm trying to
more
and more.
As opposed to just doing a magic trick.
Yeah.
You try to let them into your world.
I try to do that more and more. And what I've found lately is, like, I try to catch myself. There's this very kind of Jim Carrey-ish dynamic to my character that I can be very high energy. I can be very kind of... it's hard to describe, but there's this like Jim Carrey thing going on mm-hmm. with the character. And what I found lately is that used to get me a lot of laughs. And so I would kind of mine that tunnel. Right.
Okay.
And what I found more and more is that I think the show is stronger when I catch myself saying or doing something that isn't me. Mm-hmm. Like I try to, like, if there's a voice that's like, no, that's not how you talk, man. Like just catching yourself in that moment, and the more I can just talk to them, you know,
right.
The more powerful it's become. And that's an evolving process for me.
Like, do you try to keep, obviously you try to keep that fresh, but I mean,
yeah.
is that something that is the same in every show that you kind of have the same moment? In other words,
yes,
telling them the same story.
There are moments of story where it's like, okay, this is where I'm very genuine and I'm just sharing with you and it's important that I be that, but it's also just kind of like a global thing that I'm trying to be more aware of whenever I'm on
sure.
stage is
sure.
just being more being less cartoonish and more kind of just this is me, you know,
right.
this is I forget who said it. It was some 18th century writer or another. But it was, if somebody wrote a book that was called The Contents of My Heart Laid Bare, and the book was true to the title, it would be a bestseller. Any one of us, like
yeah.
if any one of us was just, and I haven't, you know, obviously I'm in environments where I'm representing other people's brands. I'm representing, so I'm not advocating that necessarily on stage. But I am in terms of truthful responses to things, you know,
sure.
and
well, the reason I mentioned that
yeah.
I guess is because I had just come I saw Darren Brown's show on Broadway, and the first I would say 5 to 8 minutes he's doing nothing except sitting in a chair and revealing himself to the audience, and it's a beautiful narrative and very well scripted, but it sounds like it's genuinely being said for the first time.
First, I'm incredibly jealous because I really want to see this show from everything that I've heard about it. So first, I'm very jealous of you, Scott.
It's a really good show. He's running through January the 6th, I believe.
Awesome. Yeah. I will see that. I will. Yeah. That is worth the trip. So, yeah. I think for me, and Darren might, well, maybe he's not different in the United States because he's introducing himself. He's not
That's
the
correct.
Same level, you know, he's introducing himself to American audiences.
Cause he told me that this is kind of like the best of, you know, cause I asked if he had done the same show
yeah.
in London, like in the West Side. And he said bits of it. He said, I've done this and this. And he said, this is really kind of the best of stuff I've done. So
really
that's why this is a good
in
show.
This market. Yeah,
yeah.
It's interesting to watch people at that level because their success is not an accident.
Mm-hmm.
And what Darren's doing is really fascinating to watch because he's really established in this one geographic market.
Right.
And now he's saying, let me launch myself. So we get to kind of watch from the outside. So how's he launching
right.
himself in this new market? And that's really interesting too. I think for me, what I was about to say, I'm a big advocate of the really emotionally connective thing and the really honest laying yourself bare thing happening at the very end of the show.
Mm-hmm.
That to me, the structure that I base my shows on is focus, rapport, climax, and then emotional connection. So that last moment And we're in a different environment than Darren is, because people have been, you know, auctioning off their children to afford the ticket, right? And they're very excited about seeing this, and they're coming out to a formal theater to see somebody who is extraordinary in an environment where everything about the environment subconsciously says, this is worth my time and attention.
Right.
So the first phase of that show, the focus phase, is a little bit different for Darren in that environment, right? Mm-hmm. For us, if I'm working a corporate event, these are people who are there not because they want to be there. They're there because they have to be there. And maybe
that's a good point.
Maybe it's 8 in the morning. Maybe they've been, you know, out drinking the night before. They're from a different time zone. If they're salespeople, maybe there's something else that they, you know, they feel like they're being taken out of the field and maybe losing money to come to this stupid event, right?
Right.
And so for us, earning their focus literally means getting their eyes to move from the phone in their lap up to the stage, right?
That's a big challenge.
You got to get them to look down from there into there. And one of the reasons for my opener is that if so it's the visible vanish of a silk, and then a couple seconds later, a shot glass appears, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so if you do this with the right production support on stage, so if you have live video magnification and they see that silk vanish, what happens is those people who are watching go,
right.
And the people who are looking at their phones,
so what did I miss?
What did I miss? And they look up, and then a couple seconds later, this thing appears out of nowhere, and now you've got them.
That's right? A very good point.
I think that's, I think, I, and I don't, I can't speak to it authoritatively because I haven't seen the show. And I also, with people like Darren, I also operate on the assumption that if I don't think they're doing something well, or if there's something I see wrong with it, part of it might be that I'm just not experienced and smart enough to understand the reasons why they're right. So I come to people like that with a great deal of humility when I'm thinking about their shows and what they're doing.
Right.
But yeah, we're in a very different environment. And so I do think that personal revelation is important. But the problem is, performers can sometimes be very self-indulgent and think that the audience cares about learning about them before we really do care about learning about you. Once you've earned my attention, once I'm like, okay, this guy deserves me to spend 45 minutes of my life mm-hmm. watching him, you know, 45 minutes that at my deathbed I won't have back, right?
Yeah.
Once they're there, now they want to see what's behind the mask, and now they want to get to know you and all of that. But before they care about you, they don't.
You know, I hadn't thought about the reasons behind that, but I've got a gypsy thread that I do at the end that talks about my life and growing up and my meeting my wife and marrying and children, grandchildren, my wife's death and different things, you know, that happened in my life so that people have an emotional tie to me then at the end. And then I'll say, you know, good night.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't leave them on such a negative note, but it's something in which that, you know, afterwards that people will come up and then they feel that they can talk with you, say, man, it's a great show. And that, and they feel that they can talk to me because I've personalized myself, you know, I guess. And I hadn't thought about why I did that, but that's exactly the reason. And I like what you said about the three points of that. First of all, what'd you say? Engage and rapport.
Oh, so for me, it's first is focus. I earn their focus.
Yeah.
Then I develop rapport with them. I build a relationship, and we also mold them. There's a difference between a bunch of people sitting in a room and an audience.
Mm-hmm.
So we get them laughing together, goofing off, the music with the balloon being bounced around through the house. We have this party atmosphere. We bring them together as an audience. Then we deliver that amazing thing that they're going to be talking about for the next couple of weeks, the linking finger rings, right? If we're going to compress my act down to its most essential elements. And then at the end, we have this moment of emotional connection. And mine's not as resonant as yours, but I have I do a silk-in egg that is about that. I'll put it this way. It's about the way that we... that impossible things are around us all the time and we take them for granted.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's a connecting, it's not as personalized and as emotional, but it's the most emotionally evocative thing I have in my commercial show.
Gotcha.
So, but that's the place for that. And it's kind of like, I think about it, you know, it's Judy Garland sitting on the stool at the end of the night. And
exactly.
And you feel like she's singing just to you.
Good analogy.
You know.
Very good. Taking this in a completely different direction, I was going to ask you then also about working with Penn & Teller.
Mm.
And that you mentioned Mike Close a little bit earlier,
yeah,
of course.
Yeah.
And back then, of course, that's when Johnny Thompson was still alive and with us back then. Did they contact you, or how did that come about?
I reached out to them. And first, let me say, you're talking about four of my biggest heroes on the planet.
Yeah.
And just the idea, forget any of the business value or anything else, just the treasure of being able to work with those four in some capacity is something mm-hmm. that really means a lot, and that I'll carry with me the rest of my life. And that's one of the big gifts that we have in magic, is that the people we grew up idolizing at such a small community that we end up getting to work with them. And it's like, oh, that's so awesome. I reached out to them mm-hmm. and I was very deliberate in my process. So when I first heard the idea for the show, I thought it was going to be awful. Like, I hated the idea. When I just heard, like, people are going to go on, they're going to try to fool Penn & Teller, and Penn & Teller are going to tell them how to do it.
Right.
I thought, oh, man, this is going to be. And it wasn't that it was going to be exposing as much as, and there's a little bit of this to the show. There's a little bit of this dimension. It's that it's reducing the experience of magic and making the role of the audience to bust the magician.
Oh,
and there is some of, like, I do have those concerns about the.
But isn't that what every audience does? I mean, in other words, people come with a natural curiosity and knowing that it's a puzzle.
Yeah.
I mean, sure, there are some people who believe in real magic, but I mean, for the most part, people are real sentient human beings and realize that this is trickery and they want to know the secret.
Yeah, and of course. But I think there's a difference between that and defining, saying, let me put it this way. I had a, and then I'm going to tell you why this show is so great.
Okay.
So I don't want to sound like, I think it's been personally huge for me. It's been great for magic. It's been amazing. And we'll talk about all of those reasons. But just to frame what the concern is, I had a little girl come up to me at a meet and greet at a public show in Orlando. And she was there because she was a Penn & Teller fan, and her parents had mentioned that, like, she saw you on there and she loved it. And she said something like, and I forget the exact quote, but it was something like, well, we weren't smart enough to, you know, and so you fooled us. And I was like, whoa, stop right there. Like, and so you're right. Of course, an audience is trying to figure out what a trick is. But I think there's a difference between that and saying that's what it is supposed to be, like saying for magic, like, this is what the experience is, this is this puzzle, I want you to find it out, versus here's this amazing thing, let me share it with you.
Mm-hmm.
And let's move past, you know, let me, you know, let, and not about a battle of wills and not about a suggestion of who's smart and who's not, you know. But that's my one little hesitation about it. Now, the reality is it's brought us incredible great magic, put it on a major platform, and it would not exist without the hook. So this is me just being like, man, wouldn't it be nice if this was different? But it's this amazing great thing, right? And one of the reasons it's great is, you know, it came right on the heels of some TV magic that kind of pushed, you know, started to do editing and camera tricks and Confederates, and then got really inartful with it, like just got really lazy and that's not really blame. I mean, maybe there were intense production schedules and blah, blah, blah. There are all kinds of reasons that people can give, but it became very transparent to anybody who's intelligent. It's like, oh, they're in on this.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
so the genius of the format, number one, anything that gets TV magic on TV and puts it in a really positive light is great for all of us. It needs to be celebrated by all of us. But what was really genius about the format is by having two people whose reputations are invested in busting the performer, you know, there aren't Confederates, there aren't editing tricks, there aren't, although you still, I say that and then I read the YouTube comments and I'm like, you idiot.
Yeah.
No, she wasn't in on this because, But so it does, that message doesn't get through to everybody, but I think it gets through to, it allows people to enjoy magic on TV as magic and mm-hmm. give the credit mm-hmm. where it belongs.
Good point.
And that's worth celebrating. So my story with them, I saw all of these things. I saw that it was a national TV platform that was accessible to a performer of my level. And that more importantly, unlike sort of talent contest shows, I could tell that they really cared about putting the performer forward in the right light. So there's a real challenge to, you know, there's a whole process behind making it down the line to actually getting hired, to being filmed, and then to actually making air. Because one of the important things, and I've seen people make mistakes on the shoot itself because they didn't realize this. One thing to realize is even when you're hired to perform and go shoot, that doesn't mean that your segment's going to make air.
I've heard that. I thought they all made it, but I talked to people and said no.
And mathematically, I believe that's the case, that I believe that they hire around, I don't know, I'm not going to give exact numbers, but around 50 acts, and they can air something like 40 or something like that.
Sure.
So there's a given percentage that if they hired, you know, Matt King and Max Maven and David Copperfield and Darren Brown and, you know, name your very favorite people, mm-hmm. One of those acts wouldn't make TV, right? Just
right.
Mathematically, one of those would have to be cut. So that's something.
Well, I just heard that recently, like that Harrison Greenbaum had performed, and apparently he had some line that CW said, "We're not going to let this air."
Well, I don't know the story with Harrison, but there are phenomenal performers where it just didn't work out, right? Mm-hmm. And that's just something to be aware of. So we can talk more as we go deeper into the experience about some of the things to do to avoid, as you're thinking about maybe doing this, some of the things to do that can potentially avoid, the cutting line. But so what I did, I realized, hey, this is a great opportunity. I really want to be a part of this. I'd long been a fan of Mike Close. The Workers books were huge to me as a teenager. They changed the way I thought about magic and the way I structured things.
I still do some of the things from those.
Yeah. And not just the tricks, but like Mike's assumptions, like the trick is over assumption that he talks about in Workers. One of the major pieces in my show relies on that. And so it's not just the specific tricks, but it's the thinking behind them that's incredible. So I've always been a huge fan of Mike's, and we happen to be Facebook friends, you know, one of the beautiful things of prior to the shoot. And I just sent him a message that was right after they had been renewed, just, hey, congratulations on the renewal. You guys are doing great work. Do you think the team would be open to looking at video from acts that might not be on the radar? And what's the best way to get in front of them? I'd really appreciate any help. And he said, sure, here's the email address. And so what I did was then I looked at my repertoire, and there was nothing in my show that made sense for Fool Us, I thought. And so I had to create something. I had to figure that out. So what I did was I binge watched every episode that had aired up to that point. So I was in I ended up being in season 3. And so it was seasons 1 and 2, the season in the UK and then the first season in the United States. But I was watching for something particular. Who were the performers I had never heard of?
Mm-hmm.
Because if I had heard of someone, it was possible that the producers were already aware of their work, loved their work, and were like, what's this person going to bring to the show, right? But if I hadn't heard of them, there was probably something about the material itself that could tell me what the producers were looking for. And as I was studying that, I realized there were two things that stood out to me at that point. One was that they seemed to be very interested in visually different props. And that was something Mike said in his email. He said, by the way, he didn't say the visual, he didn't extrapolate it to that extent, but he said, by the way, it's going to be really hard to get on with card tricks. Right.
Yeah.
And so I pulled out from that and from what I was looking some of the things that I thought were weaker that were on air, those were really interesting to look at, because it's like, well, what are they seeing in this to help me see what their standards are? So it seemed to be very visually different props, and they seemed to like presentations that nodded towards contemporary culture or technology or things like that. And so I found an old entry in my notebook. I'd always been fascinated with Harry Ng's Impossible Bottles.
Impossible Bottles, sure.
I love them. But I thought that they deserved to be something. I didn't like the idea of it just being this thing that was on the shelf. I wanted to create a trick that created an impossible bottle, and then that could be given to the audience. So I, in my notebook was this idea for taking a card trick from 1947 and an Abracadabra magazine and applying it to an impossible bottle. And I ran with that. And there was a lot of, for me, there was just, and I had to, because of the timeline. So I had finished developing the trick like a week before I filmed my audition tape for them. And so I'd literally done this thing maybe four times on stage. So I've been since about 2015. I'm one of a great group of performers who fills in for Tony Brent, who's incredible, doing a dinner comedy show in Orlando, Florida at WonderWorks. And I'm one of the guys who's on rotation there. And so I did it at WonderWorks. It's been one of these places where I can work in the middle, I can work in new material. And right. That's really important to me. Having those kinds of venues. And so I shot this audition thing and it was okay, but I knew that it was going to need work if it was going to make it, if it was eventually going to air. So what I did was I just worked on that as if it was going to be on national TV, not knowing if I'd been booked or not. That way, if I did get the gig, that's great. I had this thing that was ready to go. If I didn't, I had this highly polished piece.
Right.
And just through reaching out to connections and stuff, I found ways to do it, I think, about 75 times between, on stage, between sending them the video and
actually being on
and actually doing it. And it may have been closer to 100, and that was great. So I had this new piece, but that's so important. And it was something I was kind of humbled talking to Mike. I came and did the rehearsal and he was like, he and Johnny were like, we don't have any notes. It was just over preparing and anything to deal with TV.
And how'd that turn out? Once you were on stage?
Really well. So because I watch it now and I cringe because, it's a nerve-wracking environment. And so my delivery is sure. faster than it should be and all of that stuff. But what happened, I wanted to write a comic monologue that was specifically about the show to lead into it because I wanted to kind of stand out. I was treating this as a showcase. You've got 9 cameras, you've got these celebrities, here's this great footage that I knew I was going to be using for years to come. And so I wanted to establish at the beginning, I'm funny, I'm able to be funny about something that's custom and specific, right? Mm-hmm. So I wanted to write some jokes about the show and also just the format of the show is lots of comedic potential
sure,
in that.
Exactly.
And it's like, let me mine that. And so what helped was I knew, I wasn't going to, I intentionally wasn't looking at Penn and Teller when I first walked out because I didn't want that intimidation factor.
You're looking at the audience.
I'm just looking at the audience and scanning. And I heard this huge laugh from Penn on the capper to that monologue. So I'm like, I'm 33. When I heard that laugh, I just completely relaxed and,
right.
and everything was, and it was very smooth, but it feels like a big blur still.
And at the end, did you fool him?
No. So, and what happened was that the element in my trick that I knew that everything up to the impossible object itself, mm-hmm. I knew Teller's going to know the
sure.
Harbin trick. They've been around Devil's Hanks. I chose the Devil's
right.
Hank because I thought it might give me, and it did, a kind of cool quote when he coded it back.
Mm-hmm.
So they're like, oh, this is the work of the devil. And I'm
yeah.
like, this is the work of the devil. And Teller did in an email say, please feel free to
use
to he said anything we say in the segment feel free to quote and I felt like that was the one element that could. So I was talking to Mike during the rehearsal and I was like, so do you think that, just so I know what to say, because to back up with not making air, one of the reasons people haven't in the past is they want a really positive, uplifting, clean ending to the segment. They want man, that was amazing, but it didn't fool Penn and Teller, but it was so great, give it up for. Or,
right.
man, that was amazing, and they fooled Penn and Teller. They want a clean ending. And when people argue too much or are really ego invested in getting the trophy, and there have been cases like this where there was a great segment, and then the person just refused to, no, I fooled you. No, you didn't. Back up. And they can't use
yeah,
that.
Right. No.
And so I knew that going in. And so I said to Mike, look, I just want to know, do you guys think that the preparation of the jar should be considered as part of the fooling? And he said, I really need to talk to Johnny about that. Let's get back to you. And their schedule is so insane. Mike, and when Johnny was with us, Johnny's schedule on the show, there's so much coming at them that that email just never went out. So I just never heard back from them. So I'm standing there on stage, and Penn's shaking the jar, and he's like, well, we have no idea how you did this, but we sure hope you can buy one of these. And I make impossible objects myself, you can, of course, buy them. And so I had this choice to make of, did I want to try to like litigate this little detail and try and argue my way to the FU and potentially not give them a segment they can use? Mm-hmm. And do I want to make it all about this kind of little issue, right? And in the same point, do I want to highlight that you can buy them, which I kind of don't want my lay audiences to know?
Right.
So I just swallowed my pride and just said, they've got me completely 100%. Thank you guys so much. Really appreciate the opportunity. Right. And now I've got a video on my YouTube channel with 1.4 million views.
Wow.
And that's nothing compared to, you know, people who really, really had segments that performed incredibly well, but, it's something I sure didn't have before, and I'm grateful I did.
Wow. So, yeah. Well, that's great. Well, listen, I appreciate that. That was a lot of good detail and interesting information for people who might be interested, you know, in trying to go forth on the show as well. So as we start to wrap up, the name of my podcast is called The Magic Word. So I always like to close this in finding, what is it that's your philosophy of life? You know, what do you live by? So it's not necessarily a word. It could be a phrase.
Connection. It's like all about other people. And it's about, you know, if you do well enough for other people, you know, good things are going to happen for you.
Sure. It's going to come back.
All right.
That's great. Nathan, this has been wonderful. Thanks very much. Wow. And I wish you good luck in the future then as well.
Thank you so much, Scott. Appreciate you.
Going on. It's for the Magic Word Podcast. That was Nathan Coe Marsh. This is Scotty out. Man, I don't know about you, but that was some pretty good stuff there. Thanks very much, Nathan. I really enjoyed our conversation, and also the stuff you shared. That was some pretty inside baseball, secret stuff there. So thank you, and I hope you listeners have paid close attention to that then as well. Well, next week, I'm going to be heading out to Las Vegas for the Society of American Magicians annual convention. It's one of those kind of things that's difficult to choose. Last year, I went to the Magi Fest, and this year, the SAM has decided to hold their convention instead of the summer. They're going to be having it in the winter at Las Vegas, and so I'm going to be going to that. I know that the Magi Fest is going to be phenomenal, with the guest being David Williamson, so I know that's going to be really good, plus a lot of other great guests that they've got with Danny Ortiz and David Stone, etc. Nevertheless, I will be in Las Vegas, and I'll be doing some daily updates from there. This is also just a reminder that there will not be a podcast that will be released next Thursday, as we normally do, because I'll be in Las Vegas. And as such, actually, the first activity starts late Friday night, so there'll be a few things then, and then all day Saturday. So I'm going to give a daily report, actually combining days one and two, if you will, or kind of that pre-convention. I call it day one, but really, there are a few things happening. So that'll probably come out very early on Sunday morning, perhaps late Saturday night, but I suspect it'll be after midnight by the time I get back up to the room and get everything all put together and everything. So you'll be looking at really something coming out on Sunday the 19th, probably. So don't expect a podcast to be coming out then next Thursday as it normally does. Sorry about that, but I've got a pretty hectic schedule once I get to Las Vegas and putting these daily convention updates together. Be sure to sign up for our weekly pod letter if you have not already done so, which gives you some information as to what's going on, what we're doing each week, and also you'll be the first to know whenever we have some contests, and you can we're also reminding people to go out and to enter those contests then as well. So I think it's about time to wrap up here and get ready to head to Vegas here pretty soon, I guess. So until next week, stay well, get booked, and remember to do good things for other people, and good things will come your way. This is Scotty out.